The porter looked round. "Mr. Chailey, nice to see you back again, sir. Sorry I had a spot of bother. Hope that's all behind you now."
"Indeed, Bill, it is. You find me thriving. And Mrs. Roberts, how is she? Foot still troubling her?"
"Not since she had it off, thanks for asking, sir. Between you and me, sir, I would have been just as happy to have had her amputated and kept the foot. I had a little spot reserved on the mantelpiece, but there we are. We have to take things as we find them."
"Mr. Macduff, sir," he added, nodding curtly at Richard.
"Oh, that horse you mentioned, sir, when you were here last night. I'm afraid we had to have it removed. It was bothering Professor Chronotis."
"I was only curious, Bill," said Richard. I hope it didn't disturb you."
"Nothing ever disturbs me, sir, so long as he isn't wearing a dress. Can't abide it when the young fellows wear dresses, sir."
"If the horse bothers you again, Bill," interrupted Dirk, patting him on the shoulder, "send it up to me and I shall speak with it. Now, you mentioned the good Professor Chronotis. Is he in at the moment? We've come on an errand."
"Far as I know, sir. Can't check for you because his phone's out of order. Suggest you go and look for yourself. Far left corner of Second Court."
"I know it well, Bill, thank you, and my best to what remains of Mrs. Roberts."
They swept on through into First Court, or at least Dirk swept, and Richard walked in his normal heron-like gait, wrinkling up his face against the measly drizzle. Dirk had obviously mistaken himself for a tour guide. "St. Sid's," he pronounced, "the College of Coleridge and the College of Sir Isaac Newton, renowned inventor of the milled-edged coin and the cat flap."
"The what?" said Richard.
"The cat flap. A device of the utmost cunning, perspicuity, and invention. It is a door within a door, you see."
Yes, said Richard. "There was also the small matter of gravity."
"Gravity," said Dirk, with a slightly dismissive shrug. "Yes, there was that as well, I suppose. Though that, of course, was merely a discovery. It was there to be discovered."
He took a penny out of his pocket and tossed it casually onto the pebbles that ran alongside the paved pathway.
"You see," he said, "they even keep it on at weekends. Someone was bound to notice sooner or later. But the cat flap, there is a very different matter. Invention, pure creative invention.
I would have thought it was quite obvious. Anyone could have thought of it."
"Ah," said Dirk, "it is a rare mind indeed that can render the hitherto non-existent blindingly obvious. The cry, 'I could have thought of that,' is a very popular and misleading one, for the fact is that they didn't, and a very significant and revealing fact it is too. This, if I am not mistaken, is the staircase we seek. Shall we ascend?"
Without waiting for an answer, he plunged on up the stairs.
Richard, following uncertainly, found him already knocking on the inner door. The outer one stood open.
"Come in," called a voice from within.
Dirk pushed the door open, and they were just in time to see the back of Reg's white head as he disappeared into the kitchen.
"Just making some tea," he called out. "Like some? Sit down, whoever you are."
"That would be most kind," returned Dirk. "We are too."
Dirk sat, and Richard followed his lead.
"Indian or China?" called Reg.
"Indian, please."
There was a rattle of cups and saucers.
Richard looked around the room. It seemed suddenly humdrum. The fire was burning quietly to itself, but the light was that of the grey afternoon. Though everything about it was the same, the old sofa, the table burdened with books, there seemed nothing to connect it with the hectic strangeness of the previous night. The room seemed to sit there with raised eyebrows, innocently saying, "Yes?"
"Milk?" called out Reg from the kitchen.
"Please," replied Dirk.
He gave Richard a smile, which seemed to him to be half mad with suppressed excitement.
"One lump or two?" called Reg again. "One, please," said Dirk, "and 2 spoons of sugar, if you would."
There was a suspension of activity in the kitchen. A moment or two passed, and Reg stuck his head around the door.
"S'flat Chailey!" he exclaimed. "Good heavens! Well, that was quick work, young Macduff. Well done, my dear fellow. How very excellent to see you. How good of you to come."
He wiped his hands on a tea towel he is carrying, and hurried over to shake hands.
"My dear S'flat!" "Dirk, please, if you would," said Dirk, grasping his hand warmly. "I prefer it. It has more of a sort of Scottish dagger feel to it, I think. Dirk Gently is the name under which I now trade. There are certain events in the past, I'm afraid, from which I would wish to disassociate myself."
"Oh, absolutely. I know how you feel. Most of the 14th century, for instance, is pretty grim," agreed Reg earnestly.
Dirk was about to correct the misapprehension, but thought that it might be somewhat of a long trek, and left it.
"So how have you been, then, my dear Professor?" he said instead, decorously placing his hat and scarf upon the arm of the sofa.
"Well," said Reg, "it's been an interesting time recently, or rather a dull time, but dull for interesting reasons. Now sit down again, warm yourselves by the fire, and I will get the tea and endeavour to explain."
He bustled out again, humming busily, and left them to settle themselves in front of the fire. Richard leant over to Dirk.
"I had no idea you knew him so well," he said with a nod in the direction of the kitchen.
"I don't," said Dirk instantly. "We met once by chance at some dinner, but there was an immediate sympathy and rapport."
"So how come you never met again?" He studiously avoided me, of course. Close rapports with people are dangerous if you have a secret to hide, and as secrets go, I fancy that this is somewhat of a biggie. If there is a bigger secret anywhere in the world, I would very much care, he said quietly, to know what it is. He gave Richard a significant look and held his hands out to the fire. Since Richard had tried before, without success, to draw him out on exactly what the secret was, he refused to rise to the bait on this occasion, but sat back in his armchair and looked about him. "Did I ask you," said Reg, returning at that moment, "if you wanted any tea?" "Yes," said Richard. "We spoke about it at length. I think we agreed in the end that we would, didn't we?" "Good," said Reg vaguely. "By a happy chance, there seems to be some ready in the kitchen. You'll have to forgive me. I have a memory like a, what are those things you drain rice in? What am I talking about?" With a puzzled look, he turned smartly round and disappeared once more into the kitchen. "Very interesting," said Dirk quietly. "I wondered if his memory might be poor." He stood suddenly and prowled around the room. His eyes fell on the abacus, which stood on the only clear space on the large mahogany table. "Is this the table," he asked Richard in a low voice, "where you found the note about the salt cellar?" Yes, said Richard, standing and coming over, "tucked into this book." He picked up the guide to the Greek islands and flipped through it. "Yes, yes, of course," said Dirk impatiently. "We know about all that. I'm just interested that this was the table." He ran his fingers along its edge, curiously. "If you think it was some sort of prior collaboration between Reg and the girl," Richard said, "then I must say that I don't think it possibly can have been." "Of course it wasn't," said Dirk testily. "I would have thought that was perfectly clear." Richard shrugged in an effort not to get angry and put the book back down again. "Well, it's an odd coincidence that the book should have been..." "Odd coincidence?" snorted Dirk. "Ha! We shall see how much of a coincidence. We shall see exactly how odd it was. I would like you, Richard, to ask our friend how he performed the trick." "I thought you said you already knew." "I do," said Dirk airily. "I would like to hear it confirmed." "Oh, I see," said Richard. "Yes, that's rather easy, isn't it? Get him to explain it and then say, 'Yes, that's exactly what I thought it was.' Very good, Dirk. Have we come all the way up here in order to have him explain how he did a conjuring trick? I think I must be mad." Dirk bridled at this. "Please do as I ask," he snapped angrily. "You saw him do the trick. You must ask how he did it. Believe me, there is an astounding trick hidden within it. I know it, but I want you to hear it from him." He spun round as Reg re-entered, bearing a tray, which he carried round the sofa and put on the low coffee table that sat in front of the fire. "Professor Chronotis," said Dirk. Reg, said Reg, "please." "Very well," said Dirk. "Reg." "Sieve!" exclaimed Reg. "What?" "Thing you drain rice in. A sieve. I was trying to remember the word, though I forget now the reason why. No matter. Dirk, dear fellow, you look as if you were about to explode about something. Why don't you sit down and make yourself comfortable?" "Thank you, no. I would rather feel free to pace up and down fretfully, if I may. Reg." He turned to face him square on and raised a single finger. "I must tell you," he said, "that I know your secret." "Ah, yes. Do you indeed?" Mumbled Reg, looking down awkwardly and fiddling with the cups and teapot. "I see." The cups rattled violently as he moved them. "Yes, I was afraid of that. And there are some questions that we would like to ask you. I must tell you that I await the answers with the very greatest apprehension." "Indeed, indeed," Reg muttered. "Well, perhaps it is at last time. I hardly know myself what to make of recent events, and am fearful myself. Very well, ask what you will." He looked up sharply, his eyes glittering. Dirk nodded curtly at Richard, turned and started to pace, glaring at the floor. Said Richard, "well, I'd be interested to know how you did the conjuring trick with the salt cellar last night." Reg seemed surprised and rather confused by the question. "The conjuring trick," he said. "Yes," said Richard, "the conjuring trick." Said Reg, taken aback. Well, the conjuring part of it, I'm not sure I should. Magic circle rules, you know, very strict about revealing these secrets, very strict. Impressive trick, though, don't you think?" he added slyly. "Well, yes," said Richard. It seemed very natural at the time, but now that I think about it, I have to admit that it was a bit dumbfounding." "Ah, well," said Reg, it's skill, you see, practice, make it look natural." "It did look very natural," continued Richard, feeling his way. I was quite taken in." "You liked it? It was very impressive." Dirk was getting a little impatient. He shot a look to that effect at Richard. "And I can quite see," said Richard firmly, "why it's impossible for you to tell me. I was just interested, that's all. Sorry I asked." "Well," said Reg in a sudden seizure of doubt,
I suppose, well, so long as you absolutely promise not to tell anyone else, he carried on, I suppose you can probably work out for yourself that I used two of the salt cellars on the table. No one was going to notice the difference between one and another. The quickness of the hand, you know, deceives the eye, particularly some of the eyes around that table. While I was fiddling with my woolly hat, giving, though I say so myself, a very cunning simulation of clumsiness and muddle, I simply slipped the salt cellar down my sleeve, you see? His earlier agitation had been swept away completely by his pleasure in showing off his craft. It's the oldest trick in the world, in fact, he continued, but nevertheless takes a great deal of skill and deftness. Then a little later, of course, I returned it to the table with the appearance of simply passing it to someone else. Takes years of practice, of course, to make it look natural, but I much prefer it to simply slipping the thing down to the floor. Amateur stuff, that. You can't pick it up, and the cleaners never notice it for at least a fortnight. I once had a dead thrush under my seat for a month. No trick involved there, of course. A cat killed it. Reg beamed. Richard felt he'd done his bit, but hadn't the faintest idea where it was supposed to have got them. He glanced at Dirk, who gave him no help whatsoever, so he plunged on blindly. Yes, he said, yes, I understand that can be done by sleight of hand, but what I don't understand is how the salt cellar got embedded in the pot. Reg looked puzzled once again, as if they were all talking at cross purposes. He looked at Dirk, who stopped pacing, and stared at him with bright, expectant eyes. Well, that's perfectly straightforward, said Reg. Didn't take any conjuring skill at all. I nipped out for my hat, you remember? Yes, said Richard doubtfully. Well, said Reg, while I was out of the room, I went to find the man who made the pot. Took some time, of course, about 3 weeks of detective work to track him down, and another couple of days to sober him up, and then, with a little difficulty, I persuaded him to bake the salt cellar into the pot for me. After that, I briefly stopped off somewhere to find some powder to disguise the suntan, and of course I had to time the return a little carefully so as to make it all look natural. I bumped into myself in the anteroom, which I always find embarrassing. I never know where to look, but, there you have it. He smiled a rather bleak and nervous smile. Richard tried to nod, but eventually gave up. What on earth are you talking about? He said. Reg looked at him in surprise. I thought you said you knew my secret, he said. I do, said Dirk, with a beam of triumph. He as yet does not, though he furnished all the information I needed to discover it. Let me, he added, fill in a couple of little blanks, in order to help disguise the fact that you had, in fact, been away for weeks, when, as far as anyone sitting at the table was concerned, you had only popped out of the door for a couple of seconds. You had to write down for your own reference the last thing you said, in order that you could pick up the thread of conversation again as naturally as possible. An important detail, if your memory is not what it once was, yes? What it once was, said Reg, slowly shaking his white head. I can hardly remember what it once was, but, yes, you are very sharp to pick up such a detail. And then there is the little matter, continued Dirk, of the questions that George III asked you. This seemed to catch Reg quite by surprise. He asked you, continued Dirk, consulting a small pocketbook he had pulled from his pocket, if there was any particular reason why one thing happened after another, and if there was any way of stopping it. Did he not also ask you, and ask you first, if it was possible to move backwards in time, or something of that kind? Reg gave Dirk a long and appraising look. I was right about you, he said. You have a very remarkable mind, young man. He walked slowly over to the window that looked out onto Second Court. He watched the odd figures scuttling through it, hugging themselves in the drizzle or pointing at things. Yes, said Reg at last in a subdued voice, that is precisely what he said. Good, said Dirk, snapping shut his notebook with a tight little smile which said that he lived for such praise. Then that explains why the answers were yes, no, and maybe, in that order. Now, where is it?
Where is what?
The time machine. You're standing in it, said Reg. Chapter 26. A party of noisy people spilled into the train at Bishop Stortford. Some were wearing morning suits with carnations, looking a little battered by a day's festivity. The women of the party were in smart dresses and hats, chattering excitedly about how pretty Julia had looked in all that silk taffeta,
how Ralph still looked like a smug oaf, even done up in all his finery, and generally giving the whole thing about 2 weeks. One of the men stuck his head out of the window and hailed a passing railway employee just to check that this was the right train and was stopping at Cambridge. The porter confirmed that of course it bloody was. The young man said that they didn't all want to find they were going off in the wrong direction, did they? And made a sound a little like that of a fish barking, as if to indicate that this was a pricelessly funny remark, and then pulled his head back in, banging it on the way. The alcohol content of the atmosphere in the carriage rose sharply. There seemed to be a general feeling in the air that the best way of getting themselves in the right mood for the post-wedding reception party that evening was to make a foray to the bar so that any members of the party who were not already completely drunk could finish the task. Rowdy shouts of acclamation greeted this notion, the train restarted with a jolt, and a lot of those still standing fell over. Three young men dropped into the three empty seats round one table, of which the fourth was already taken by a sleekly overweight man in an old-fashioned suit. He had a lugubrious face, and his large, wet, cow-like eyes gazed into some unknown distance. Very slowly, his eyes began to refocus all the way from infinity, and gradually to home in on his more immediate surroundings, his new and intrusive companions. There was a need he felt as he had felt before. The three men were discussing loudly whether they would all go to the bar, whether some of them would go to the bar and bring back drinks for the others, whether the ones who went to the bar would get so excited by all the drinks there that they would stay put and forget to bring back any for the others who would be sitting here anxiously awaiting their return, and whether even if they did remember to come back immediately with the drinks, they would actually be capable of carrying them and wouldn't simply throw them all over the carriage on the way back, incommoding other passengers. Some sort of consensus seemed to be reached, but almost immediately none of them could remember what it was. Two of them got up, then sat down again as the third one got up. Then he sat down, the two others stood up again, expressing the idea that it might be simpler if they just bought the entire bar. The third was about to get up again and follow them, when slowly but with unstoppable purpose, the cow-eyed man sitting opposite him leant across and gripped him firmly by the forearm. The young man in his morning suit looked up as sharply as his somewhat bubbly brain would allow, and startled, said, "What do you want?" Michael Wenton Weeks gazed into his eyes with terrible intensity, and said in a low voice, "I was on a ship."
"What?"
"A ship," said Michael.
"What ship? What are you talking about? Get off me! Let go!"
"We came," continued Michael, in a quiet, almost inaudible but compelling voice, "a monstrous distance. We came to build a paradise, here." His eyes swam briefly round the carriage and then gazed briefly out through the spattered windows at the gathering gloom of a drizzly East Anglian evening. He gazed with evident loathing. His grip on the other's forearm tightened.
"Look, I'm going for a drink," said the wedding guest, though feebly, because he clearly wasn't.
"We left behind those who would destroy themselves with war," murmured Michael. "Ours was to be a world of peace, of music, of art, of enlightenment. All that was petty, all that was mundane, all that was contemptible would have no place in our world." The stilled reveller looked at Michael wonderingly. He didn't look like an old hippie. Of course, you never could tell. His own elder brother had once spent a couple of years living in a druidic commune, eating LSD donuts and thinking he was a tree, since when he'd gone on to become a director of a merchant bank. The difference, of course, was that he hardly ever still thought he was a tree, except just occasionally, and he had long ago learnt to avoid the particular claret which sometimes triggered off that flashback. "There were those who said we would fail," continued Michael, in his low tone that carried clearly under the boisterous noise that filled the carriage, "who prophesied that we too carried in us the seed of war. But it was our high resolve and purpose that only art and beauty should flourish. The highest art, the highest beauty, music. We took with us only those who believed, who wished it to be true."
"But what are you talking about?"
asked the wedding guest, though not challengingly, for he had fallen under Michael's mesmeric spell.
"When was this? Where was this?"
Michael breathed hard. "Before you were born," he said at last, "be still and I will tell you."
Chapter 27. There was a long, startled silence, during which the evening gloom outside seemed to darken appreciably and gather the room into its grip.
A trick of the light wreathed Reg in shadows. Dirk was, for one of the few times in a life of exuberantly prolific loquacity, wordless. His eyes shone with a child's wonder as they passed anew over the dull and shabby furniture of the room, the panelled walls, the threadbare carpets. His hands were trembling. Richard frowned faintly to himself for a moment, as if he was trying to work out the square root of something in his head, and then looked back directly at Reg.
"Who are you?" he asked.
"I have absolutely no idea," said Reg brightly. "Much of my memory's gone completely. I am very old, you see, startlingly old. Yes, I think if I were to tell you how old I was, it would be fair to say that you would be startled. Odds are that so would I, because I can't remember. I've seen an awful lot, you know. I've forgotten most of it, thank God. Trouble is, when you start getting to my age, which, as I think I mentioned earlier, is a somewhat startling one, did I say that? Yes, you did mention it. Good, I'd forgotten whether I had or not. The thing is that your memory doesn't actually get any bigger, and a lot of stuff just falls out. You see, the major difference between someone of my age and someone of yours is not how much I know, but how much I've forgotten. And after a while, you even forgot what it is you've forgotten, and after that, you even forgot that there was something to remember. Then you tend to forget what it was you were talking about." He stared helplessly at the teapot. "Things you remember," prompted Richard gently.
"Smells and earrings."
"I beg your pardon?"
"Those are the things that linger for some reason," said Reg, shaking his head in a puzzled way. He sat down suddenly. "The earrings that Queen Victoria wore on her silver jubilee, quite startling objects, toned down in the pictures of the period, of course. The smell of the streets before there were cars in them. Hard to say which was worse. That's why Cleopatra remains so vividly in the memory, of course. Quite a devastating combination of earrings and smell. I think that will probably be the last thing that remains when all else has finally fled. I shall sit alone in a darkened room. Sans teeth, sans eyes, sans taste, sans everything but a little grey old head, and in that little grey old head a peculiar vision of hideous blue and gold dangly things flashing in the light, and the smell of sweat, cat food, and death. I wonder what I shall make of it." Dirk was scarcely breathing as he began to move slowly round the room, gently brushing his fingertips over the walls, the sofa, the table. "How long," he said, "has this been?"
"Here," said Reg, "just about 200 years, ever since I retired."
"Retired from what?"
"Search me. Must have been something pretty good, though. What do you think?"
"You mean you've been in the same set of rooms here for 200 years? Murmured Richard. "You'd think someone would notice, or think it was odd."
"That's one of the delights of the older Cambridge colleges," said Reg. "Everyone is so discreet. If we all went around mentioning what was odd about each other, we'd be here till Christmas. Slad, Dirk, my dear fellow, please don't touch that just at the moment."
Dirk's hand was reaching out to touch the abacus standing on its own on the only clear spot on the big table.
"What is it?" said Dirk sharply.
"It's just what it looks like, an old wooden abacus," said Reg. "I'll show you in a moment, but first I must congratulate you on your powers of perception. May I ask you how you arrived at the solution?"
"I have to admit," said Dirk with rare humility, "that I did not. In the end I asked a child. I told him the story of the trick and asked him how he thought it had been done, and he said, and I quote, 'It's bleeding obvious, isn't it? He must have had a bleeding time machine.' I thanked the little fellow and gave him a shilling for his trouble. He kicked me rather sharply on the shin and went about his business. But he was the one who solved it. My only contribution to the matter was to see that he must be right. He had even saved me the bother of kicking myself."
"But you had the perception to think of asking a child," said Reg. "Well, then I must congratulate you on that instead."
Dirk was still eyeing the abacus suspiciously.
"How does it work?" he said, trying to make it sound like a casual inquiry.
"Well, it's really terribly simple," said Reg. "It works any way you want it to. You see, the computer that runs it is a rather advanced one. In fact, it is more powerful than the sum total of all the computers on this planet, including, and this is the tricky part, including itself. Never really understood that bit myself, to be honest with you, but over 95% of that power is used in simply understanding what it is you want it to do. I simply plonk my abacus down there, and it understands the way I use it. I think I must have been brought up to use an abacus when I was a child, I suppose. Richard, for instance, would probably want to use his own personal computer.
If you put it down there, where the abacus is, the machine's computer would simply take charge of it and offer you lots of nice user-friendly time-travel applications, complete with pull-down menus and desk accessories, if you like. Except that you point to 1066 on the screen, and you've got the Battle of Hastings going on outside your door, if that's the sort of thing you're interested in. Reg's tone of voice suggested that his own interests lay in other areas. It's really quite fun in its way, he concluded. Certainly better than television, and a great deal easier to use than a video recorder. If I miss a program, I just pop back in time and watch it. I'm hopeless fiddling with all those buttons. Dirk reacted to this revelation with horror.
You have a time machine, and you use it for watching television?
Well, I wouldn't use it at all if I could get the hang of the video recorder. It's a very delicate business, time travel, you know, full of appalling traps and dangers. If you should change the wrong thing in the past, you could entirely disrupt the course of history. Plus, of course, it mucks up the telephone. I'm sorry, he said to Richard a little sheepishly, that you were unable to phone your young lady last night. There seems to be something fundamentally inexplicable about the British telephone system, and my time machine doesn't like it. There's never any problem with the plumbing, the electricity, or even the gas. The connection interfaces are taken care of at some quantum level I don't entirely understand, and it's never been a problem. The phone, on the other hand, is definitely a problem. Every time I use the time machine, which is, of course, hardly at all, partly because of this very problem with the phone goes haywire, and I have to get some lout from the phone company to come and fix it, and he starts asking stupid questions, the answers to which he has no hope of understanding. Anyway, the point is that I have a very strict rule that I must not change anything in the past at all, Red sighed. Whatever the temptation.
What temptation? Said Dirk sharply.
Oh, it's just a little thing I'm interested in, said Reg, vaguely. It is perfectly harmless, because I stick very strictly to the rule. It makes me sad, though.
But you broke your own rule, insisted Dirk. Last night you changed something in the past.
Well, yes, said Reg, a little uncomfortably. But that was different, very different. If you had seen the look on the poor child's face, so miserable. She thought the world should be a marvellous place, and all those appalling old dons were pouring their withering scorn on her just because it wasn't marvellous for them any more. I mean, he added, appealing to Richard, remember Corley, what a bloodless old goat. Someone should get some humanity into him, even if they have to knock it in with a brick. No, that was perfectly justifiable. Otherwise I make a very strict rule.
Richard looked at him with dawning recognition of something.
Reg, he said politely, may I give you a little advice?
Of course you may, my dear fellow. I should adore you to, said Reg.
If our mutual friend here offers to take you for a stroll along the banks of the River Cam, don't go.
What on earth do you mean?
He means, said Dirk earnestly, that he thinks there may be something a little disproportionate between what you actually did and your stated reasons for doing it.
Oh, well, odd way of saying it.
Well, he's a very odd fellow, but you see, there sometimes may be other reasons for things you do which you are not necessarily aware of, as in the case of post-hypnotic suggestion, or possession.
Reg turned very pale.
Possession, he said. Professor Reg, I believe there was some reason you wanted to see me, said Richard. What exactly was it?
Cambridge! This is Cambridge!
Came the lilting squawk of the station public address system.
Crowds of noisy revellers spewed out onto the platform, barking and honking at each other.
Where's Rodney?
Said one, who had clambered with difficulty from the carriage in which the bar was situated. He and his companion looked up and down the platform totteringly. The large figure of Michael Wenton Weeks loomed silently past them and out to the exit. They jostled their way down the side of the train, looking in through the dirty carriage windows. They suddenly saw their missing companion still sitting trance-like in his seat in the now almost empty compartment. They banged on the window and hooted at him. For a moment or two he didn't react, and when he did, he woke suddenly in a puzzled way, as if seeming not to know where he was.
"He's pie-eyed!"
his companions bawled happily, bundling themselves onto the train again and bundling Rodney back off. He stood woozily on the platform and shook his head. Then, glancing up, he saw through the railings the large bulk of Michael Wenton Weeks, heaving himself and a large heavy bag into a taxicab, and stood for a moment transfixed.
"Extraordinary thing," he said. "That man telling me a long story about some kind of shipwreck."
"Ha ha!" gurgled one of his two companions. "Get any money off you?"
What? Said Rodney, puzzled.
No, no, I don't think so. Except it wasn't a shipwreck, more an accident, an explosion. He seems to think he caused it in some way, or rather there was an accident and he caused an explosion trying to put it right and killed everybody. Then he said there was an awful lot of rotting mud for years and years, and then slimy things with legs, so it's all a bit peculiar.
Trust Rodney to pick a madman. I think he must have been mad.
He suddenly went off on a tangent about some bird. He said the bit about the bird was all nonsense. He wished he could get rid of the bit about the bird. And then he said it would be put right. It would all be put right. For some reason, I didn't like it when he said that.
Ah, should have come along to the bar with us. Terribly funny.
I also didn't like the way he said goodbye. I didn't like that at all.
Chapter 28.
You remember, said Reg, when you arrived this afternoon, I said that times recently had been dull but for interesting reasons.
I remember it vividly, said Dirk. It happened a mere 10 minutes ago. You were standing exactly there, as I recall. Indeed, you were wearing the very clothes with which you are currently apparelled, and
shut up, Dirk, said Richard. Let the poor man talk, will you?
Dirk made a slight apologetic bow.
Quite so, said Reg. Well, the truth is that for many weeks, months even, I have not used the time machine at all because I had the oddest feeling that someone or something was trying to make me do it. It started as the very faintest urge, and then it seemed to come at me in stronger and stronger waves. It was extremely disturbing. I had to fight it very hard indeed, because it was trying to make me do something I actually wanted to do. I don't think I would have realized that it was something outside of me creating this pressure, and not just my own wishes asserting themselves, if it wasn't for the fact that I was so wary of allowing myself to do any such thing. As soon as I began to realize that it was something else trying to invade me, things got really bad, and the furniture began to fly about. Quite damaged my little Georgian writing desk. Look at the marks on the...
Is that what you were afraid of last night, upstairs? Asked Richard.
Oh, yes, said Reg in a hushed voice. Most terribly afraid. But it was only that rather nice horse, so that was all right. I expect it just wandered in when I was out getting some powder to cover up my suntan.
Oh, said Dirk, and... Where did you go for that? He asked. I can't think of many chemists that a horse would be likely to visit.
Oh, there's a planet off in what's known here as the Pleiades, where the dust is exactly the right...
You went, said Dirk in a whisper, to another planet to get face powder?
Oh, it's no distance, said Reg cheerfully. You see, the actual distance between two points in the whole of the space-time continuum is almost infinitely smaller than the apparent distance between adjacent orbits of an electron. Really, it's a lot less far than the chemist, and there's no waiting about at the till. I never have the right change, do you? Go for the quantum jump is always my preference. Except, of course, that you then get all the trouble with the telephone. Nothing's ever that easy, is it?
He looked bothered for a moment.
I think you may be right in what I think you're thinking, though, he added quietly.
Which is?
That I went through a rather elaborate bit of business to achieve a very small result. Cheering up a little girl, charming, delightful, and sad though she was, doesn't seem to be enough explanation for... Well, it was a fairly major operation in time engineering, now that I come to face up to it. There's no doubt that it would have been simpler to compliment her on her dress. Maybe the ghost. We are talking about a ghost here, aren't we?
I think we are, yes, said Dirk slowly.
A ghost, said Richard. Now, come on.
Wait, said Dirk abruptly. Please continue, he said to Reg.
It's possible that the a ghost... caught me off my guard. I was fighting so strenuously against doing one thing that it easily tripped me into another.
And now? Said Dirk.
Oh, it's gone completely. The ghost left me last night.
And where, we wonder, said Dirk, turning his gaze on Richard, did it go?
No, please, said Richard, not this. I'm not even sure I've agreed we're talking about time machines yet, and now suddenly it's ghosts.
So what was it? Hissed Dirk, that got into you to make you climb the wall.
Well, you suggested that I was under post-hypnotic suggestion from someone.
I did not.
I demonstrated the power of post-hypnotic suggestion to you, but I believe that hypnosis and possession work in very, very similar ways. You can be made to do all kinds of absurd things, and will then cheerfully invent the most transparent rationalizations to explain them to yourself. But you cannot be made to do something that runs against the fundamental grain of your character. You will fight. You will resist. Richard remembered then the sense of relief with which he had impulsively replaced the tape in Susan's machine last night. It had been the end of a struggle which he had suddenly won. With the sense of another struggle that he was now losing, he sighed and related this to the others. "Exactly," exclaimed Dirk. "You wouldn't do it. Now we're getting somewhere. You see, hypnosis works best when the subject has some fundamental sympathy with what he or she is being asked to do. Find the right subject for your task, and the hypnosis can take a very, very deep hold indeed. And I believe the same to be true of possession. So, what do we have? We have a ghost that wants something done and is looking for the right person to take possession of to do that for him. Professor?" Reg, said Reg. Reg, may I ask you something that may be terribly personal? I will understand perfectly if you don't want to answer, but I will just keep pestering you until you do. Just my methods, you see. You said there was something that you found to be a terrible temptation to you, that you wanted to do but would not allow yourself, and that the ghost was trying to make you do. Please, this may be difficult for you, but I think it would be very helpful if you would tell us what it is. I will not tell you, said Reg. You must understand how important. I'll show you instead, said Reg. Silhouetted in the gates of St. Sed's stood a large figure carrying a large, heavy, black nylon bag. The figure was that of Michael Wenton Weeks. The voice that asked the porter if Professor Chronotis was currently in his room was that of Michael Wenton Weeks. The ears that heard the porter say he was buggered if he knew because the phone seemed to be on the blink again was that of Michael Wenton Weeks. But the spirit that gazed out of his eyes was no longer his. He had surrendered himself completely. All doubt, disparity, and confusion had ceased. A new mind had him in full possession. The spirit that was not Michael Wenton Weeks surveyed the college which lay before it, to which it had grown accustomed in the last few frustrating, infuriating weeks. Weeks, mere microsecond blinks. Although the spirit, the ghost, that now inhabited Michael Wenton Weeks's body, had known long periods of near oblivion, sometimes even for centuries at a stretch, the time for which it had wandered the earth was such that it seemed only minutes ago that the creatures which had erected these walls had arrived. Most of his personal eternity, not really eternity, but a few billion years could easily seem like it, had been spent wandering across interminable mud, wading through ceaseless seas, watching with stunned horror when the slimy things with legs suddenly had begun to crawl from those rotting seas, and here they were, suddenly walking around as if they owned the place and complaining about their phones. Deep in a dark and silent part of himself, he knew that he was now mad, had been driven mad almost immediately after the accident, by the knowledge of what he had done and of the existence he faced, by the memories of his fellows who had died and for a while had haunted him, even as he had haunted the earth. He knew that what he now had been driven to would have revolted the self he only infinitesimally remembered, but that it was the only way for him to end the ceaseless nightmare in which each second of billions of years had been worse than the previous one. He hefted the bag and started to walk. Chapter 29. Deep in the rainforest, it was doing what it usually does in rainforests, which was raining, hence the name. It was a gentle, persistent rain, not the heavy slashing which would come later in the year, in the hot season. It formed a fine dripping mist, through which the occasional shaft of sunlight would break, be softened, and pass through on its way towards the wet bark of a calvaria tree, on which it would settle and glisten. Sometimes it would do this next to a butterfly or a tiny, motionless, sparkling lizard, and then the effect would be almost unbearable. Away up in the high canopy of the trees, an utterly extraordinary thought would suddenly strike a bird, and it would go flapping wildly through the branches, and settle at last in a different and altogether better tree, where it would sit and consider things again more calmly until the same thought came along and struck it again, or it was time to eat. The air was full of scents,
the light fragrance of flowers, and the heavy odour of the sodden mulch with which the floor of the forest was carpeted. Confusions of roots tangled through the mulch. Moss grew on them, insects crawled. In a space in the forest, on an empty patch of wet ground between a circle of craning trees, appeared, quietly and without fuss, a plain white door. After a few seconds it opened a little way with a slight squeak. A tall, thin man looked out, looked around, blinked in surprise, and quietly pulled the door closed again. A few seconds later the door opened again, and Reg looked out. "It's real," he said, "I promise you. Come out and see for yourself." Walking out into the forest, he turned and beckoned the other two to follow him. Dirk stepped boldly through, seemed disconcerted for about the length of time it takes to blink twice, and then announced that he saw exactly how it worked, that it was obviously to do with the unreal numbers that lay between minimum quantum distances and defined the fractal contours of the enfolded universe, and he astonished at himself for not having thought of it himself. "Like the cat flap," said Richard, from the doorway behind him. Yes, quite so," said Dirk, taking off his spectacles and leaning against a tree, wiping them. "You spotted, of course, that I was lying. A perfectly natural reflex in the circumstances, as I think you'll agree. Perfectly natural." He squinted slightly and put his spectacles back on. They began to mist up again almost immediately. "Astounding," he admitted. Richard stepped through more hesitantly and stood rocking for a moment with one foot still on the floor in Reg's room and the other on the wet earth of the forest. Then he stepped forward and committed himself fully. His lungs instantly filled with the heady vapours and his mind with the wonder of the place. He turned and looked at the doorway through which he had walked. It was still a perfectly ordinary door frame with a perfectly ordinary little white door swinging open in it, but it was standing free in the open forest, and through it could clearly be seen the room he had just stepped out of. He walked wonderingly round the back of the door, testing each foot on the muddy ground, not so much for fear of slipping as for fear that it might simply not be there. From behind, it was just a perfectly ordinary door frame, such as you might fail to find in any perfectly ordinary rainforest. He walked through the door from behind, and looking back again, could once more see, as if he had just stepped out of them again, the college rooms of Professor Urban Chronotis of St. Sed's College, Cambridge, which must be thousands of miles away. Thousands? Where were they? He peered off through the trees and thought he caught a slight shimmer in the distance between the trees. "Is that the sea?" he asked. "You can see it a little more clearly from up here," called Reg, who had walked on a little way up a slippery incline and was now leaning, puffing, against a tree. He pointed. The other two followed him up, pulling themselves noisily through the branches and causing a lot of cawing and complaining from unseen birds high above. "The Pacific?" asked Dirk. "The Indian Ocean," said Reg. Dirk wiped his glasses again and had another look. "Ah, yes, of course," he said. "Not Madagascar?" said Richard. "I've been there." "Have you?" said Reg. "One of the most beautiful and astonishing places on earth, and one that is also full of the most appalling temptations for me. No." His voice trembled slightly, and he cleared his throat. "No," he continued, "Madagascar is, let me see, which direction are we? Where's the sun? Yes, that way, westish. Madagascar is about 500 miles, roughly, west of here. The island of Reunion lies roughly in between." "What's the place called?" said Dirk, suddenly rapping his knuckles on the tree and frightening a lizard. "Place where that stamp comes from. Mauritius." "Stamp?" said Reg. "Yes, you must know," said Dirk. "Very famous stamp. Can't remember anything about it, but it comes from here. Mauritius. Famous for its very remarkable stamp, all brown and smudged, and you could buy Blenheim Palace with it. Or am I thinking of British Guyana?" "Only you," said Richard, "know what you are thinking of." "Is it Mauritius?" "It is," said Reg. "It is Mauritius." "But you don't collect stamps?" "No." "What on earth's that?" said Richard suddenly. But Dirk carried on with his thought to Reg. "Pity you could get some nice first-day covers, couldn't you?" Reg shrugged. "Not really interested," he said. Richard slithered back down the slope behind them. "So, what's the great attraction here?" said Dirk. "It's not, I have to confess, what I was expecting. Very nice in its way, of course, all this nature, but I'm a city boy myself, I'm afraid." He cleaned his glasses once again and pushed them back up his nose. He started backwards at what he saw and heard a strange little chuckle from Reg. Just in front of the door, back into Reg's room, the most extraordinary confrontation was taking place. A large cross bird was looking at Richard.
and Richard was looking at a large cross bird. Richard was looking at the bird as if it was the most extraordinary thing he'd ever seen in his life, and the bird was looking at Richard as if defying him to find its beak even remotely funny. Once it had satisfied itself that Richard did not intend to laugh, the bird regarded him instead with a sort of grim, irritable tolerance, and wondered if he was just going to stand there or actually do something useful and feed it. It padded a couple of steps back and a couple of steps to the side, and then just a single step forward again on great waddling yellow feet. It then looked at him again, impatiently, and squawked an impatient squawk. The bird then bent forward and scraped its great absurd red beak across the ground, as if to give Richard the idea that this might be a good area to look for things to give it to eat. "It eats the nuts of the calvaria tree," called out Reg to Richard. The big bird looked sharply up at Reg in annoyance, as if to say that it was perfectly clear to any idiot what it ate. It then looked back at Richard once more and stuck its head on one side, as if it had suddenly been struck by the thought that perhaps it was an idiot it had to deal with, and that it might need to reconsider its strategy accordingly. "There are one or two on the ground behind you," called Reg softly. In a trance of astonishment, Richard turned awkwardly and saw one or two large nuts lying on the ground. He bent and picked one up, glancing up at Reg, who gave him a reassuring nod. Tentatively, Richard held the thing out to the bird, which leant forward and pecked it sharply from between his fingers. Then, because Richard's hand was still stretched out, the bird knocked it irritably aside with his beak. Once Richard had withdrawn to a respectful distance, it stretched its neck up, closed its large yellow eyes, and seemed to gargle gracelessly as it shook the nut down its neck into its maw. It appeared then to be at least partially satisfied. Whereas before it had been a cross dodo, it was at least now a cross-fed dodo, which was probably about as much as it could hope for in life. It made a slow, waddling, on-the-spot turn, and padded back into the forest whence it had come, as if defying Richard to find the little tuft of curly feathers stuck up on its backside even remotely funny. "I only come to look," said Reg in a small voice, and glancing at him, Dirk was discomforted to see that the old man's eyes were brimming with tears, which he quickly brushed away. "Really, it is not for me to interfere." Richard came scurrying breathlessly up to them. "Was that a dodo?" he exclaimed. "Yes," said Reg, "one of only three left at this time. The year is 1676. They will all be dead within 4 years, and after that no one will ever see them again. Come," he said, "let us go." Behind the stoutly locked outer door in the corner staircase in the second court of St. Zed's College, where only a millisecond earlier there had been a slight flicker as the inner door departed, there was another slight flicker as the inner door now returned. Walking through the dark evening towards it, the large figure of Michael Wenton Weeks looked up at the corner windows. If any slight flicker had been visible, it would have gone unnoticed in the dim, dancing firelight that spilled from the window. The figure then looked up into the darkness of the sky, looking for what it knew to be there, though there was not the slightest chance of seeing it, even on a clear night, which this was not. The orbits of Earth were now so cluttered with pieces of junk and debris that one more item among them, even such a large one as this was, would pass perpetually unnoticed. Indeed, it had done so, though its influence had from time to time exerted itself, from time to time, when the waves had been strong. Not for nearly 200 years had they been so strong as now they were again. And all at last was now in place. The perfect carrier had been found. The perfect carrier moved his footsteps onwards through the court. The professor himself had seemed the perfect choice at first, but that attempt had ended in frustration, fury, and then inspiration, bring a monk to Earth. They were designed to believe anything, to be completely malleable. It could be suborned to undertake the task with the greatest of ease. Unfortunately, however, this one had proved to be completely hopeless. Getting it to believe something was very easy. Getting it to continue to believe the same thing for more than 5 minutes at a time had proved to be an even more impossible task than that of getting the professor to do what he fundamentally wanted to, but wouldn't allow himself. Then another failure, and then, miraculously, the perfect carrier had come at last. The perfect carrier had already proved that it would have no compunction in doing what would have to be done. Damply, clogged in mist, the moon struggled in a corner of the sky to rise.
At the window, a shadow moved.
Chapter 30. From the window overlooking Second Court, Dirk watched the moon. "We shall not," he said, "have long to wait."
"To wait for what?" said Richard.
Dirk turned. "For the ghost," he said, "to return to us. Professor," he added to Reg, who was sitting anxiously by the fire, "do you have any brandy, French cigarettes, or worry beads in your rooms?"
No, said Reg.
"Then I shall have to fret unaided," said Dirk, in return to staring out of the window.
"I have yet to be convinced," said Richard, "that there is not some other explanation than that of ghosts to—"
"Just as you required actually to see a time machine in operation before you could accept it," returned Dirk. "Richard, I commend you on your scepticism, but even the sceptical mind must be prepared to accept the unacceptable when there is no alternative. If it looks like a duck and quacks like a duck, we shall have at least to consider the possibility that we have a small aquatic bird of the family Anatidae on our hands."